Previously on Solve the World.
When they're all back together, once they're asleep, let's cause a little landslide. Separate Miles from the other two. Then, let's see, maybe it's time to play our Merkel card. Send Merkel in, to Miles. Have Merkel make up a story. That he has a plan. That he can save Lex if she's the one left behind. Get Merkel here. We'll come up with a story. If we can convince Miles that he can win, from all sides, if we get him and one hand off the island, then everything will fall into place. Miles will bring the rescue team, maybe some military, and we'll have our world platform finally. This is working better than I could have dreamed. God is blessing us, 038. Oh, how he loves us.
Solve the World, a fictional adventure told in 100 episodes.
I don't really know what happens next. Chronology is a tough pony to mount, if you ask me.
Episode 61, Workers of the Apocalypse. First act of Constable was to regulate each child and worker into companies of 200. There was a day, not long after his arrival, that adults called Lottery Day. Each child was randomly assigned a number 1 to 200. Along with that number, a little digital screen with an open jack slash port was put into each child's hand. These devices, they looked like something between an iPod mini and a pedometer, and boasted in large green, yellow, or red the exact number of the child. This lottery was carried out, and the devices assigned, with the only instruction being to carry the device on your person at all times. It wasn't until some time later that the awful news concerning the numbers and their intention came into being. On a cold, dark morning, the constable boomed his orders to the masses. "We must read this!" He took out a crinkled-up paper from his pocket. "The world is harsh. To stay at Anmo, you must be harsh. The world is cruel. To stay at Anmo, you must learn to be cruel. The world is dog-eat-dog. To stay at Anmo, you must learn to rid yourself of pity. The world is indignant. To stay at Anmo, you must know that love costs more than it gives. The world is dying. To stay at Anmo, you must learn what it means to stay alive. The world envies you. To stay at Anmo, you must hate the world." The constable paused here, I guess for dramatic effect. "Each of you has a number. That is your number. If your number is 21, all the way up to 200, consider yourself lucky. You will notice your number is green. If you have a number 3 to 20, your number is yellow. Let this day stand as a warning for you. If you are cursed with a red 1 or 2, I am sorry. Your lot in life is to be hard. You will find survival in being a beast of burden, or you will not find survival at all. Listen carefully now, children. You are free from the bonds you were once shackled by. No longer must you ride the stationary bikes. If you do not like the bikes, don't ride them. You are free to do anything you like. But all things have a cost, either to your body, your mind, or your future. Today is Monday. On Saturday, red-numbered children from every company will be thrown out of Anmo. There are trains that will take you away. I will not say where. That's 1% of the population. 1% every Saturday will be taken away. Additionally, we will have a lottery. If your number is yellow on the time of judgment on Saturday, then you will be entered into this lottery. One yellow child per company will also be taxied away from Anmo forever. That is how this is to be done. Fret not, children. Do you not like the number you have been assigned? Your constable is just. The greatest empire in the history of humanity was the Roman Empire. For over 1,000 years, their system was not a democracy, letting majority rule. It wasn't a dictatorship, a monarchy, a system ruled by one despot. Nor was it a theocracy, a system wherein power lies with the religious. No. Nor was it an oligarchy, power given to the few. Children, it was this, and nothing more. A meritocracy. You want power. You want glory. You want honor? Earn it. Merit it. Climb the mountain. I said on Saturday, we shall vomit out the lowest 1% of you orphans. The lowest shall head out on trains that shall never return to Anmo's peace. I said this. This 1%. And yet I fashioned for you a scenario in which 3 of every 200 children shall face banishment. That's 1.5%. There is power in merit. Earn the right. On Saturday, whomever among you in each of your companies of 200 has the highest ranking, the highest number, that child is king, is queen, is ruler, is judge for a day. They shall stand in charge of the masses. Most among their privileges is that 1 of the 3 condemned in their company they shall exonerate. They shall let free. They shall have pity on 1 of the 3. Choose the one you wish to endure. If you are condemned, of course, you will do whatever is in your power to be the one who was chosen for salvation. Entreat yourself to the ruler of the day. On Saturday, the ruler of your company, the child whose number is highest, that child's device will turn blue, from green to blue, the color of royalty. But Constable, how are we, the lowly yellows, the wretched reds, how are we to rise up? You say it is by merit. Show us what we may perform so as to rise up from our dark, deep caverns. This you may ask me. I tell you now, children, every task increases your number. Ride the stationary bikes for an hour, your number increases. Work in the Malandrinian plant for 8 hours, see your number increase by quite a fair amount. You'll know if you're in trouble by the color of your device. Red for death, yellow for warning. Green for free. Scout looked down at her number. Lucky number 13. Yellow. Miles arrived at Anmo via a bus on a Sunday morning. The bus was crammed with kids, many of them crying, all of them underdressed. It was cold, the type of cold that sent splinters into your lungs with every breath. The bus and several buses behind their own dropped Miles and several hundred children off at what looked like a refinery or granary silo. Tall stacks of white and gray smoke plumed out, never fully dissipating into the light blue sky. It was November 3rd. Miles wanted to feel good. He, for the first time since he landed at the Druidry, wasn't searching for anything. Now, he had a task. All he had to do was continue to perform said task for some time, and Jennifer Dash would come to him. Simple. Miles, though, was never much of a fan of Occam's razor. In his world, the simplest solution was never what reality ended up being. 2 smallish steel doors opened at the base of what looked like the granary portion of the community. Children stormed in. Miles slugged behind. It was good for the kids to go first. Their little bodies couldn't deal with the cold like his could. Miles preferred hot places to cold. the muscles in his face and mouth becoming an ever harder challenge to manipulate with chills. And for a man that sketched a life out based on his silver tongue and throat, let the hearer remember, losing control of your muscle dexterity is a scary thing. Today, Miles was such a bundle of anxiety it didn't matter what the calendar or climate said. He didn't like this idea of Pipers. Not one bit. In many ways, he didn't like Piper. Miles assumed no one did. He's a hard guy to like. Maybe impossible. Beyond just being moody, controlling, and generally aloof, he seemed absolutely impossible to ever relate to. He lacked that gene in him that almost everyone has that pulls you to engage with a person the moment you find a hint of something in common with them. The Piper lacked this gene. It was one of the reasons Miles knew in his heart that people like him were absolutely necessary to the Piper's overarching operations. Without a charismatic on his team, the Piper would be flushed. Perpetually, you would think he'd go to extra lengths then to appease his talent. You'd think he'd give Miles what he wants so he can go away and do his friggin' job. But making things easy is never in the old fiddler's cards. The truth is, Miles Faw would have abandoned him long ago had he not seen the other side. Think what you will of the old man's tactics. He's fighting a noble war. No part of Miles doubted that. Thus, for a while now, Miles followed the Piper's fiddle and fife. Pretty much for the good of humanity. Miles could do good in the war. He knew he could. He was a good soldier. Maybe something akin to a sniper, if you'd like to stick with that type of metaphor. He could take out specific enemies, bundle over precise targets. Miles liked the work itself. He found himself good at it. And who can complain about the globetrotting? That's just a rusty cherry on top, eh? You see, that's why Piper's insolence and inconsolable nature made life so complicated. If Faw's boss just sent him orders and, say, the orders were clean, Miles would be happy to carve out a life for himself. But with the Pied Piper, it's never that way. Take, for instance, the latest boggle of the Orion. Miles had a specific task there. Get Jennifer Dash to the quiet room. There, in that silence, the Piper could sniff her out once and for all. See for himself what she was all about. Come to terms with what part she had to play in the Grand Symphony. That was the game plan. Miles had his orders. Simple enough. It would have been, had the Piper not had another plant on board without telling Miles. A plant who had completely separate orders from Miles altogether. How could Miles not have known, not have figured it? That was a shame he'd likely take to his grave. Of course, Miles knew about Pishtako. For as long as he had known the Piper, the little island experiment had been on the radar. The Great White Hope, Piper often called it. The Lonely Plague was half of Piper's exit plan. The other half, nuclear war, was the half that Miles, heretofore, had spent all of his energy on. Miles didn't know much of anything about the island. Honestly, didn't want to know. The run-in with the known triangle came as a surprise then. Miles knew it was entirely possible that the two vessels at that time came into contact entirely by chance. That's part of the equation that conspiracy theorists never get. In their anxious little minds, they design a world built on the backs of a few powerful folk. Those folk then, somehow, either supernaturally or by alien instruction or who knows what, control the story of humanity through the ages with 100% certainty. They never fail. They never miss a beat. Any oddity, any apparent contradiction in the grand narrative is merely a window in which conspiracists can fall through. Fall deeper. Fall eternally. The truth is that even the most powerful can only control a few factors in life. So much of life is ruled by that vixen we call chaos. She can never be tamed. When Miles found himself, or rather chose to find himself, on Pishtako's island, it was the bravest thing he'd ever done. In the pit, he was absolutely terrified. Nothing had gone to plan. And worse still, he knew enough to know that he and Jennifer and Lex were in a whole heap of danger. He was scared. It wasn't until Merkel went missing that he started to understand. And even then, not fully. Not until he saw the numbered man with his own eyes and heard what he had to say. Then, it started to come into focus. Near the very end of the train of children, Miles passed the steel doors of Onmo. He shivered as his shoulders touched the cold tin walls of the corridors leading to the main hall. Once in the main hall, adults and even some children corralled kids into sections. Devices with numbers were handed out. A dolt named Lupita grabbed Miles, insisting he do this and this and this. She was hard to understand, her accent quite thick. But it didn't matter what words or language she used. Miles was elsewhere. He had scanned the large, stadium-sized room looking for one of two people. One may suspect that he'd run into the constable first. Of course, the constable would recognize Miles. The two would have a powwow. Miles was anxious about this. He wanted to punch the constable in the face. But it wasn't the new foreman known as Constable that Miles spotted first. No, Marshal Winston caught his eye. Marshall was just about at the other side of the room, busy, corralling children, tugging arms and whispering things into ears. Piper was right. Marshall was already working hard at his task, undermining the foreman. Did the constable not notice him? In this large theater, a minute into Miles' stay at Onmo, it was already breathlessly clear that Marshall was unlike all the other dolts. Why hadn't the constable noticed this? Or anyone else, for that matter? The trick now was, how could he get over there? Lupita was pulling him aside towards a door that led who knows where.
Excuse me.
Miles announced over the din of the room. It worked. Lupita smiled and let go of his arm. Even in this drafty place, Miles still had his touch. His silver tongue still paying dividends. Miles then pushed, like a salmon jumping up the current of a river, through the crowd of little ones. Could he really do this? Could he be a harbinger of doom for all these children? Killing people is abstract. Until it isn't. Miles knew the truth, a truth he'd told himself 1,000 times over. Death is not the end. That served him well when he was making sure the current U.S. president, the commander-in-chief of the Third World War, would get elected. Death is not the end for that. It was abstract. Millions, billions even, of lives devastated by the actions of Miles and a careful few others. It didn't seem to matter. But combing through this corridor of children, this was something different entire. Killing children. Finally, Miles reached Marshall. They stood toe-to-toe, but the volume in the room was so loud that only shouting could convey meaning here. Maybe that was why Marshall was whispering into the children's ears. Maybe it was less suspicious than Miles, at first glance, concluded.
Marshall, it's me, Miles. You know, for a genius, you're kind of dumb.
Marshall yelled and grinned. Clearly, Marshall recognized him. The two were enemies by nature. Both wanted to protect Jennifer Dash. Both wanted Jennifer Dash. The second statement made them irreconcilable. But here, in a place void of lollipop-sucking Jen, maybe they could form a tentative alliance.
Can we talk?
Miles yelled.
That's tough.
Marshall caught a boy by the hand as he tried to mill past him.
One sec.
Bending down, Marshall brought his lips to the little boy's ears. The boy's expression turned solemn. He nodded along as Marshall whispered. Try as he might, Miles wasn't adept at reading lips. He couldn't make out Marshall's words to the wee one. Finished now, the boy ran off and Marshall returned his attention to Miles.
It's hard to find a place alone here. There's always feet bumbling about. You speak any other languages?
Miles asked, but before Marshall could answer, the constable had taken center stage. He boomed down to the new recruits.
I am your constable, your dolt, will address to you the manner in which we run Onmo. Now, I must read this. You must hear it. Lo, 'tis a gala night. Within the lonesome latter years, an angel throng bewinged bedight, in veils drowned in tears, sit in a theater to see a play of hopes and fears, while the orchestra breathes fitfully the music of the spheres. Mimes in the form of God on high mutter and mumble low, and hither and thither fly, mere puppets they who come and go. At bidding of vast formless things that shift the scenery to and fro, flapping from out their condor wings. Invisible woe. That motley drama, oh, be sure, it shall not be forgot. With its phantom chased forevermore by a crowd that sees it not, through a circle that ever returneth in to the self-same spot, and much of madness and more of sin and horror, the soul of the plot. But see, amid the mimic rout, a crawling shape intrude, a blood-red thing that writhes from out the scenic solitude. It writhes! With mortal pangs, the mimes become its food, and seraphs sob at vermin fangs in human gore imbued. Out are the lights, out all. And over each quivering form, the curtain, a funeral pall, comes down with the rush of a storm, while the angels, all pallid and wan, uprising, unveiling, affirm that the play is the tragedy, man, and its hero, the conqueror, Worm.
As the new foreman, the man simply known now as Constable of Onmo, finished reading the Edgar Allan Poe poem, he saw his own shipmate, Miles Faw, staring up at him from the crowd. He sent one of his assistants to fetch the young mind reader. Constable retired to his office, where Miles Faw met him just a few minutes later. Their conversation went as follows.
Hello, Miles.
Hello, Merkel. You look different. I can't even recognize you. There were some burns and lacerations I had to endure on the island. It was thought better that I be put back together as someone else entirely. The world is beginning to uncover who the numbered man is. It was deemed best that I not be found out to be among the crew of the Orion. Thus, this. Merkel pet his face with one thick finger. You know why I'm here? Miles asked. I can only assume. There's a mole. One of the workers is playing for the other side. Merkel sighed. When I started the new curriculum here, I had half a mind to implement a similar policy for the dolts. I ruled against the inclination, thinking it best to create loyalty among my paid. If you're correct, then, I see the error in my judgment. I assume you don't know the identity of this person? No, that's why he sent me. Merkel chewed on that response, testing its taste, trying his best to surmise if there was anything left unsaid in its fiber. So he sent you to discover him. Yes. Miles looked at a small circular window, one of the only windows in all of Onmo. It was snowing now. Let me ask you the simplest question. He didn't tell me much about the operation, as I'm sure you can imagine. Merkel threw up his hands and smiled. By all means. Why not just turn off the heat? If the goal's to exterminate this place, that seems like the simplest solution. Mulling over his response, Merkel grabbed a set of keys off his desk and used one key from it to open a drawer. From it, he pulled out a bottle of rum and two shot glasses. He poured each, offered it to Miles. Instinctively, Miles shook his head no. He'd been in too many situations where the drink offered contained more than mere alcohol. Merkel chugged his own glass, then swiped Miles down as well. He poured himself a third while tending to Miles' question. The mission is much more than just extermination. Which we do, by the way. Every Saturday, 1% of the residents at Onmo are sent on a train. Out of here. Where does the train go? Miles asked, just to push the conversation forward. It motors up 120 miles or so. Then Merkel clapped his hands and sneered. It stops. What's up there? Nothing. Tundra. So why not do that with all the kids? Miles asked flatly, trying to hide his disgust for Merkel. It's one thing to kill kids. It's another entire to relish the process. Merkel downed his third shot, poured another. Sure you don't want one? This time, Miles relented. Hope is the goal. There's always a need for hope. If we don't provide the world with hope, they'll look somewhere else. We do this so that we can control the center of their hope. Merkel poured another shot, held the bottle in his hand, and examined its label. This stuff comes in from Nicaragua. It's funny, really. The whole world's gone to waste, and yet the production of fine spirits like this hasn't missed a beat. Sure, no one's farming the land anymore. No one's combing the rice paddies. But stop making alcohol? Never. Merkel downed one last shot, then ceremoniously locked the rum back up. Tell me, what's your play here? How do you intend to sniff out this traitor? Miles didn't miss a beat. I'll have to interview them all, one by one, because you're a mind reader. Of course, Miles wasn't a mind reader, but it didn't hurt his cause that Merkel thought so. I'll find your Judas. What do you need from me? Can I use your office? Merkel's smile looked more like a grimace. Sure, but I'm not giving you the key to this drawer. There was no way that Miles could interview Marshall first. That would be too dangerous. It was best to sneak him subtly in the middle of the adult lineup. It took a little over a week to get to him. It was a Tuesday, plenty of time for Miles to come up with a plan. Marshall walked into the office. Close the door, Marshall. A globe resting to his right, a pad and pencil directly in front of him. Is this safe? Sit, Miles said, annoyed. If it wasn't safe, do you think asking, is it safe, would be safe? Sorry. Let's not waste time. I don't want this meeting to go any longer than normal. I have 3 questions for you. Okay. Do you know where Jen is? No. Do you know if she's safe? No. Did you go through the graviton device? Did you end up in the same place? No. Okay, so that's 3 questions. Marshall feigned getting up. Stop that. That was all 1 question. Okay. Okay, Miles said. I think we want the same thing, Marshall. How could I know that? Marshall fidgeted in his seat. I know why you're here. Do you? You're trying to save the children. I thought you were the one asking the questions. I'm getting there. Okay. You're trying to save the children. Is that a question or a statement? It's a statement. You're trying to save the children. Constable wants this place to fail. He's actively trying to blow it up from within. How do you know that's not what I want? Marshall asked. Because I know you well enough. You're a good guy. You're one of the good guys. Is that what you believed when you tied me up to the bedpost in a cabin in the woods? I didn't know you then. I don't know you now, Marshall answered bitterly. Look, I see what you're saying. Good. Let me spell it out for you because I don't think you're as smart as everyone thinks you are. I have no reason to trust you, Miles. You clearly want something from me, but all I know is that you took Jen to Mecca and very likely was trying to use her with Sir Isaac as some kind of human sacrifice. I didn't know that was Isaac's plan. Miles projected this using his gifts so that Marshall would believe him. What do you want from me? Where did you go when you and Jen passed through? I don't know. How can you not know? I don't know. It was just some room. I want to open that passageway again. That's all I've ever wanted. I want to open it so that we can save people. Why do you want to save people? What do you care about people? That question hurt because it was mostly true. I want to be remembered as a hero, okay? Someone that used their power for good. Well, I don't know how to open that passageway or open that door or get back to that room. You and Isaac were the ones that made the graviton box, so I don't know how to help you. Is there anything you saw there? Anything? Maybe, like, a clue? Something that could help me get there? Take others back? I don't think it was that sort of place. Anything, Marshall? No, sorry. Can't help you. Marshall rose up. He was done. Wait. Miles didn't project this time. He was too unsettled. He realized just now that there really wasn't anything that Marshall could do for him. Only, he wanted Marshall to like him. Why? He wasn't sure. Jen's coming here. That stopped him. When? Marshall asked. Don't know, but I know. She's coming. That's why you're here? I want to keep her safe. Yeah. I think I'm going away. I have the beginnings of a plan, but she might come here while I'm gone. I kept her safe before. I'll keep her safe again. Yeah, that's all I need from you. Marshall pushed himself up out of his chair for a third time. Miles noticed his missing finger. How'd you lose that? My finger was the cost of getting here. Who told you where this place was? The Druidry. Why'd you go back there? Miles was projecting every word he said now. Marshall was set to answer everything like a truth serum. Merlin told me to.
Merlin?
Where is he?
In the hills of Nepal.
I can show you directions if you need them.
Miles smiled, pushed the pad and pencil towards Marshall.
Write down every detail.
Miles really wasn't sure what good Marshall could do for him before he walked into his office. Now, Miles felt like doing a handstand. He got much more than he ever expected. He got a third name.
Miles now had three names and three locations. Before the day was out, he'd head out. Honestly, two wasn't going to be enough. But three? Yeah. That could work. That could be the movement right there.
The three names. Merlin. Windigo. Mrs. Moose.
Hey, Solve the World is now on Google Play Music. If you're looking for a good podcatcher, somewhere to collect and listen to all your favorite podcasts, well, Google Play has just launched its podcast platform, so it might be the best place to listen from now on. So check us out on Google Play Music. And if you do listen there, or wherever you listen, be sure to write us a review. It would really help us out. Also, today's episode, just like every other episode, has all the sound effects and music used today listed on our show notes page. You can find that at dantestack.com. That's dantestack.com. And while you're there, tip jar. Tip jar. Come on, help me out. Tip jar.